Good evening. Thanks for your patience. My name is Chelsea Bond, and it is a real privilege tonight to bring to you the Clancestry Conversation Series. Tonight's conversation, Big Story, Little Story, is looking at the interface between these big national headlines that we hear so much about and how they impact on the lives of everyday Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. We have an amazing panel lineup, as you can see with your program. I have to confess, each of the panel members here are people that have influenced me or inspired me personally, culturally and professionally. And so it's a great privilege to have these amazing people here. And by the end of this hour, you'll understand why I look to them so highly. We also have the fantastic Mr. Wesley Enoch facilitating this yarn with us tonight. Wesley needs no introduction, but I will introduce you anyway.
Sure.
See how I go. Yeah. Wesley is a proud Noonuccal Noogie man. He is the artistic director of the Queensland Theatre Company. He is a leader in our community and cultural and arts sector. And he is just a really awesome man. So thanks, Wesley. I'll leave you to it.
There's only the only way down is down now, isn't it? Okay, from awesome to not awesome. These people are fantastic and awesome on the panel as well. And as Chelsea was saying, you've got the biogs right here. You can look at them and go, hey, that photo's a bit old, isn't it? Like this. if you want to. You can do all that because that's what it's about. But look at some of the amazing things that they've achieved. There's a song from Little Things, Big Things Grow. And for Aboriginal people, it's the other way around as well. From big things, little things grow. From everything from policies around education to employment to the native title, these big decisions that happen in houses of power, be they in federal or state parliament, these big decisions have impacts on our lives and have done for generations. From these big things, these big statements of purpose, these big decisions in Parliament, Aboriginal people live their lives responding to them, either rejecting them or embracing them, changing the way we live our life, taking advantage of some of those changes. And tonight is really a sense of, let's look at unpacking some of those big events. Yes, there's policies. Yes, there's moments that in the nation's storytelling that come to prominence that we go, whoa, how did we feel about that? Think right now about where you were when Kevin Rudd gave the apology in Parliament. Where were you? What did you feel like? What was happening in your life? For me, I was in a boardroom at the Sydney Opera House, and the boardroom stopped, and they dropped this screen. They had planned for it, and we watched Kevin Rudd, and we went, wow, and there were tears around the room. I was the only black fellow there, but all these white fellas crying, seeing how important it was. And then Brendan Nelson started speaking. We just stopped it and rolled on and went on with it. But as one, we sat there and we had a shared moment. Every single one of you have a shared moment. This sense that, yes, this big thing happened, but something happened inside you. A little thing that takes hold and grows for you. Tonight, we're going to talk about some of those big things. On the panel, as you can see by their beautiful photograph and their wonderful little bio, the lovely Matilda Barney, who's wonderful to have you here. You're such an inspiration to so many of us. As we were talking, she was talking about her six children. And how many grandchildren?
Eight
grandchildren. Well, you've got to do a bit better with the grandchildren, I think.
I'm trying to stop it now.
But that sense of growing the family. Shane Drum, you were saying you've got four children and you've got, what was it, four plus three, so another seven nephews and nieces.
Yes.
Oh, no, five plus three, that's what it was.
Yes.
So eight nephews and nieces out there.
One brother and sister.
Doing it there. And great achievements on the sporting field and doing a lot more now, working with getting young people into, well, both higher education, but thinking about the future, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and I suppose I followed my pathway and got into, you know, what I was passionate about, and which led me to where I am today. So.
Well done, thank you. I'm a bit embarrassed. I'm not wearing a tie now because I'm a bit jealous of your tie, gelling your tie. Then, Kayla Tyson, you're an inspiration to me. I know your work is pretty amazing. You're both an activist and a community leader. You know, I think that when we look at you, we see a young elder. Someone who will take a position in our community that you know, in years to come, we'll look back to these moments and see what a great contribution you're making now and what a great contribution you're making to the future. So it's wonderful to have you here, both as an artist, but also as a commentator and as a leader in our community. So wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
And Uncle Graham Brady.
Hey.
One of the last times... one of the last times Uncle Graham and I met, we were in fact in this space. We were just reminiscing about
right
that.
Here.
We did a project together called Legend back in 1990 when I had less grey hair and you had more hair.
Yeah, that's right.
And this amazing thing where we did this, well, you performed it, this performance project for young kids in this very theatre, trying to bring young people along the way. And you've been fantastic at teaching young people and bringing them along the way, teaching them both culturally and spiritually where they come from. So it's a wonderful contribution. It's so wonderful that you could be here all the way from Cairns. So can you just give the panel a round of applause? I want to start us off with what is this significant moment for all of us, if you think, your birth or a significant birth in your life. You know, where were you born? What was it like? What was the world you were born into? Who wants to start us off? Matilda, how wonderful.
I actually wanted to share the birth of my first granddaughter.
Yes.
I think at that time, I probably wasn't prepared to be a grandma. And I think some people can relate to that. Prepared, and my son was having his first daughter, his firstborn. And on that day, there was children from all around Queensland coming to Brisbane, and we were billeting some kids from Mount Isa. So we were going to the high school to pick up the kids.
And what were they being billeted for? What was the...
There was a sporting touch carnival happening in Brisbane, and there's a lot of kids coming to Brisbane, and we billeted some kids from Mount Isa. And on that day, that was the day the baby was going to be born. So I actually drove the mother to the hospital first, and then I had to go to the high school and pick up these kids. And as I went to pick up the kids, I got a phone call to say that the baby was coming. So we packed the car. You know, my white van. Everybody knows my white van at Inala. Yeah, so we packed...
How big's your white van?
Oh, 8-seater bus. Yes, but we packed it with my kids, the billets, and the suitcases, and everything, and we all ended up at Mart Hospital. So, you know, and it was like, it's something we'll never forget, all of us, because the billets came too. And when we ran in to see the baby, the billets were running with us. So we were like, yeah, welcome. You know.
Were they black fellas, the billets? Were they black
fellas? Yeah, they were, they were all
from
Mount Isa, yeah.
How fantastic.
So the kids come in with us, just so it was a big family event.
You come from a big family, though.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, both your sisters had 6 children as well.
Yeah, we all decided to stop at 6.
Why not?
So that was a memorable event.
And raising 6 children. I mean, tell us a little bit about what were some of the hardships, some of the wonderful things that raising those 6 kids.
Oh, wow.
Are they here now?
No.
What would be a normal breakfast in your household? For those 6 kids back then.
Yeah, it's very busy. It's hectic. I used to think that we were like an army camp or something, you know, everything got to be, everyone's up and breakfast time and everyone's got to go out the door and, everyone to school and mummy's got to go to work. Yeah, so it was pretty hard for me, especially when we lost their dad in 2000, and for 10 years I was a single mum with 6 kids.
How old were they at the time?
I raised them, and when their dad left, the kids were 17, to the babies were 3. Mm. The twins were 3. They were turning 4 that year, so yeah.
And I hope you don't mind me asking, how old was their father when he passed away?
Their father was 39 when he passed away. Mm. And I probably was 35, turning 36 with 6 kids. So that was It's
a big thing.
Pretty hard, yeah. But we managed, somehow you managed, and I had really good friends and family that were very supportive in the community out at Inala, were very supportive of myself and the kids, yeah. So, yes, so it was an experience, yeah. I probably can't remember the first 3 years by ourselves, but yeah, we managed, yeah.
And you thrived by the sounds of it too. And it sounds like you get a sense of that how strong family is for you too. The sense of not just the family you gave birth to, but the family you grab along the way to take along the way
and
with you.
That's right, yeah. And also my friends were like family to me too, yeah. The friends that were there close to me during that period were like family to myself and my children.
Mm. Marvellous.
Yeah.
We might move on. Another birth. Oh, well, Shane, you're looking at me.
Yeah, I'll share my own.
Yeah.
I don't remember it, but I was born and raised in Brisbane. My dad was Aboriginal, Malayan, and my mum was a white fella with an Irish heritage. And I suppose that helped pave my pathway of how I was raised, how much I was immersed in my culture and how much I would learn about my culture. And it was from the experiences my dad had growing up and also being married into a, you know, mixed-race couple and the experience they had of then would affect how much I would learn about my culture. Mm. And from growing up and those... And again, I suppose it was lack of learning about my culture in those days because of what they experienced has sort of led me to where I am now. And
what do you mean what they experienced? What are these your parents? What did they experience?
Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, they experienced a lot of racial taunts and, you know, my dad, you know, he grew up identifying as Malayan because his family... told them they were Malayan, so they would protect them from the Separation Act, and they weren't, you know, their brothers and sisters weren't taken away.
When are we talking about here? What dates do you think?
How old's my dad? I wouldn't know. But before the referendum,
yes.
You know, and he, and again, by coming on this, you know, I've learned a lot about my culture, and just in the last week or two, you know, asking him a lot of questions, and it's not that they hit us away from who we were, and you know, we still learn a lot about our culture, but probably not as much as they would have liked. And you know, ever since we've grown up, and you know, when we hit 18, they moved up north and connected with their family and their culture. They're all working in Aboriginal communities, and yes. Yeah, going back to your question now, I can't remember.
It's just really about your birth. But you say that the Malay family, I mean, I'm just thinking now, if we're talking 1950s, 1960s, that notion of, you know, how the White Australia policy worked out. I've got a great-grandfather named Fernando Gonzalez, who's a Filipino fisherman who got shipwrecked on Stradbroke Island and married into the family. And we go, oh, yeah, Filipino, yeah, a bit of that. Bit of South Sea Islander, that Fadiaki, that side of the family, that blackbirding, that, you know, the slave trade that came through, and he got shipwrecked on a lot of shipwreck on Stradbroke Island. But that sense of the White Australia policy meant that sometimes only people of colour could hang out with people of colour. So even then, a policy kind of plays through, and that the identity of being Malay is really interesting too.
Yeah, and that, you know, he was one of 10, and you know, he was telling me some of his brothers were, you know, similar skin colour, and his sisters were lighter skin colour, and the parents were worried that they'd be taken away. Yeah. So, you know, to protect their children, they, you know, identified as Malayan to, you know, to be free from that separation.
Do your 4 kids know your father?
Yes.
Yeah, so how does that all work now? How's your father look at his grandchildren?
Again, when we sort of hit 18... ish, we were all growing up. He moved back up north, you know, mum, dad and my sister. And, you know, we started to explore our culture a lot more. He connected with community, connected with culture. And it wasn't so much that he was ashamed or he was hiding from it. He was, a lot of it was just from, you know, the effects of what he experienced growing up. And, you know, again, he didn't hide us from our culture, but, you know, he was drawing on experience he had as well. So
marvellous. Oh, we might as well just keep going along. Kayla, let's talk to you about your birth or a significant birth in your life. Do you have children at all?
No.
You should have lots of children. You'd be fantastic mother. No, you'd be
fantastic. I've got
hundreds
of children in communities, but I'm not giving birth to any at the moment. I have a career. Probably the birth that affected me the most would have been the birth of my little brother. He's 6 years younger than me. And being the eldest grandchild in my family, you know, there were a couple in between, but it was like, you know, my little brother was there. And I remember being at my great auntie's house the night, and they came in at about 4:30 in the morning and said, "You got a little brother now?" And my older cousin said to me, "Oh, you know, you have to look after him no matter what. You don't fight. You just look after him all the time." And I've remembered that. I'm 27 this year, and I never fought with my brother up until last year. Seriously, he annoyed me a bit when he used to draw black in the eyes of my Beyonce posters. But apart from that, we didn't fight, and mum didn't allow it. If we ever looked like we were going to fight, then no one was allowed over until we were friends. So we just...
Do you mind talking about why you fought then? What was that fight about? Is that a big thing? Oh, you don't have to answer it if I'm being too pushy.
It was a very big thing. Drug addiction and, changed my little bro, but he's back now.
And you did a lot to help him through, obviously.
I'm the eldest, so I tell them if they're being an idiot, basically, and you don't always like to hear those kind of things, so it can be a bit confronting, but... Now he follows me around everywhere, so it must have worked.
Well done. Yeah. All strength to you. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Uncle Graham.
Yeah, what?
A birth. Either yours or someone else's.
That's significant. Oh, it has to be my son. The elder son. I have five children. I helped deliver the whole five of them.
Wow.
Yeah, I was always there to deliver them all. Back in... 82, I think it was, when my first son came along. It wasn't fashionable for husbands or dads to be at the birth gurney, I suppose. But I made it my business to be there. And his name is Kawanji. He's named after his grandfather. And... it is a name that has been passed down by our family for a millennium, because who we are Kawanjiruko Gugoyalanji. We are the Kawanji family of Gugoyalanji. So the name Kawanji was not given by me. It was given by his grandfather. My dad, Don Brady Kawanji, Wawo Kawanji, he rubbed my beautiful wife's belly. And he rubbed her belly and said, "You're going to have a boy, dear." And Jasmine, being young at the time, both young, just to note, me and Jasmine have been together for about 34 years now. And he rubbed her belly and said, "You're going to have a boy. Call him Kawanji, because that name have to live on." And so Kawanji come along. Greatest time of my life. For any dads out in the audience there that have witnessed the birth of their children, you know what I mean. I jumped for joy. I just couldn't believe how beautiful a birth is. So I had to go in for the next one. And the next one. And the next one. And the next one.
Did you stop at six? No, you had five.
I had five.
You got one left. Yeah.
Time up now.
How fantastic.
But what a beautiful thing it was. And he's 34 now, I think he is, something like that. Around that age. He's a beautiful dad to two children. I have six grandchildren now through my beautiful five children. And in our language, two sides. You got to remember, see, with the understanding of mother, father, how things work in our neck of the woods, up far north Queensland, half of the family who are on my my grandchildren who are belong to my two sons. I still have a son that hasn't. Thank goodness he's not a father yet. But I have two sons that they are fathers, and their children call me Gami, G-A-M-I, Gami, short for Gaminka. And on my daughters, I got two daughters. On their side, they call the grandchildren call me Ngaji. So you got one lot singing at Kami Ngaji, Kami Ngaji. And sometimes people get confused out in the public. What do they say? Oh, no, he called me grandfather. Well, what does he say? He called me grandfather too. But that is the beauty of understanding how your relationship work within an Aboriginal perspective that has kept our people for a long time. And having children to populate and to pro-populate, procreate, and to keep things going among our people. I'm glad to be part of that.
Lovely. Ta, Wesley. Well done. So you can hear the family in it all, can't you? It's amazing. I'm going to take us into these kind of big ideas now. Shane, I'm going to throw this to you. Kathy Freeman, where is she? Up she there. She wins the gold medal at the Sydney Olympics. Where were you? What did it make you feel like?
I was at home. You know, I think the whole of Australia were nervous. And, you know, I think as an Aboriginal person, you feel that connection to all Aboriginals. And you feel like they're all family. And, you know, she was not only representing Australia, but she was representing our people. And, you know, when she won gold, it was just a huge sense of pride. You know, again, the whole nation watching her, she lit the torch. And it was just a huge achievement for our people.
I know that torch made me nervous, yeah. That's for certain. I think, is she shaking because she's nervous or is she just really cold from that water? But that moment where, I remember I was doing a show and we stopped and we went to the Riverside stage over there and they were showing it and there were hundreds of people sitting on the grassy embankment watching it. And you got that sense of this building anticipation. She couldn't lose. She couldn't but win that gold medal because she had all of us behind her. And I found that real sense of connection. What about you, Matilda?
Yeah. I was nervous for nothing. I mean, I felt like running too. No,
I didn't.
Yeah. But yeah, even when she was 16, when she won the first
Commonwealth Games stuff, yeah.
The Commonwealth Games in New Zealand, when she, that was first gold.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, in the relay, and that was a big event. I'm sure for everyone in Australia, especially for being the first Aboriginal girl. Representing us in Commonwealth Games, and she ran with the flag.
Yeah.
And
that caused a bit of a... Mm. I remember Bruce Roxton talking about, you know, you can't carry both flags like that.
Yeah. But I think for myself anyway, that was a very proud moment, and I thought, this girl is so proud of who she is. Mm. And she's not only representing Australia, she's also representing her people. Mm. And... It actually, my kids did little athletics, and I think that was like they want to do more. So that was a good thing for the children too. When she ran that race, because she was only 16 at the time, And that really influenced a lot of our
kids. It must be hard, though, when you think that, you know, you're running, you know, and you're your own athlete, you're your individual, but you're carrying the hopes of everyone. I mean, as I'm going back to Shane here, you're a sportsman. Do you feel sometimes you go, oh, shit, do I have to be an Aboriginal sportsman as well as a sportsman? Do you feel like you go, can I carry, do I have to carry everyone's expectations all the time? Is that a hard thing?
I played a sport that was, it wasn't an individual sport, so you weren't put on the spotlight like Kathy Freeman was. But again, you know, she was representing her people and what she went through with carrying the flag and you know, she changed the state of the nation in terms of the flag. You know, it was after that they made it a national flag. So she'd already achieved a lot for our people, and you know what she did at the Olympics, you know, was just you know, huge for our people. Mm.
It was amazing.
I think topped it off. Yeah,
Uncle Graham, I'm going to ask you. We're going to go to the 67 referendum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think you're old enough to have lived through that.
No, I think I am. Yeah.
What did it feel like for you to know what that meant in the 67 referendum when it changed? What did it have an impact on your life?
Well, people got to understand that where we have a period in time that is probably a changing things. 60s was globally changing. You got to remember in 64 the big race riots in Chicago. You got to remember back to Wounded Knee for the American First Nation people. There was a spirit in the 60s, and that spirit, even Bill Gates come out of the hippie commune. That's why you have computers. The 60s, in our language, we call a feeling, an essence that is permeating through people. We call that wow. Everybody has wow. When someone die, he leave that wow behind. What went on in the 60s, and I remember it very clear, is that this wow was generating and generating all around the world. Make love, not war, peace, flower power. Everything was generating. What do you think is going to happen to Aboriginal Australia? How do you think Aboriginal Australia would not be touched by that wild war that has been happening because of the global change that the 60s had among people, the awareness, the ideologies that were breaking new ground? Of course, the 67 referendum had a big impact on me. Mm. I wasn't your average 10-year-old or 9-year-old. I was politically aware at that time. I knew about the Queensland and Torres Strait Island Act when I was 8 years old. I knew about how Blackie and Boong and have to fight at school every time. What the 67 referendum has done for myself as a person, it is just part of the greater change that human beings go through. We are part of the human being ship, you see. And so the 67 referendum had to happen. There was no other way that Aboriginal Australia was going to be left behind. So it did. Well, the impact was very meaningful, but to have an insight at such a young age, myself and my brother, we knew about these things because of our political upbringing. Our father was very politically minded. Mm-hmm. He was a theologian, and he's understanding. He talked to us, not in just the political terms, but he talked to us in the spiritual terms, in the terms of essence that makes you an Aboriginal. So when the 67 referendum comes along, it wasn't such a great shock. It's because it had to happen. And even in a young mind, as young as I was back that at that time, I was about 8, 9 years old then, we wore red headbands to school. What do you reckon, William A? We wore red headbands to school. Before the red, yellow and black flag, that red headband was for the blood of our people.
What were the reactions from your school friends? And
well, they grabbed me, him, and our other brothers and flogged us in front of the school.
For wearing a red headband?
Yes, 6 of the best. Three that side, 3 that side on parade, Milton State School. And they flogged us.
This is the teachers? Or the, like,
the yes, 6 of the best. The headmaster and the deputy. We was out, we wore red headbands to school. The teacher got myself, my brother William, and our 2 other cousin brothers. Where they used to have, if anybody been to Milton State School in the 60s, we got anybody from Milton? Okay, well, the playground's
no
here.
No teachers anyway. Yeah.
And the what's name's up here. And the and the podium's up here. This is where he gives his speech, his talk. Everybody's on parade. You march to stop, and the principal or the headmaster gives his talk. And one of the talks that he gave is that we will not tolerate indecency. We were standing behind us, 4 of us. We were standing behind him. And he said, these guys here, he did not in those words, but he said, these ones here have been doing things indecently. And he flogged us in front of the whole school. What would that make you feel as an 8-year-old boy? That's the 1967 referendum.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you for that story. I really appreciate that. It's wonderful to hear these stories, because sometimes it's that personal touch, isn't it? It's the story that comes from you. Kayla, I'm going to come to you now. There's a lot that's been going on. I know we both come from Logan. I'm from Woodridge. And you know it's true. You come from Logan. And there's a lot of stuff. Just recently in the newspapers, we're talking about that poor woman who got tasered recently in the eye, and that other poor thing that happened recently. And I know a year ago, there was all that on the news. And you've been very active about that. How did those kind of things make you feel?
When little brother Jackson Doolin passed away, I was sitting at home and I saw all the, the media was covering it, and I saw all the people that had started rocking up, in the streets when
this
the family
was the poor young fellow at the
train station, yeah. And following that, there was the fights. And I was watching the TV and I saw everyone there, and they were standing, facing off with each other, and I saw people that I knew, and they were like manly brothers, and they were crying and they were wild, and I got up and I got my keys and I went to the car and I opened the door, and then I stood there because I was so wild, and I stood there and I told myself, I need to stay home, because if I go there, I'm going to get locked up.
And you're wild, why? What made you wild about that?
Well, in that moment, like when Jackson passed away and then the riots was happening.
The Douglas Street stuff.
The two families that didn't get along. It made me realise that I'd been to over 40 funerals in my lifetime as a, just going on 26-year-old, and 10 of them were, 10-ish of them were suicides. 4 of them were what I would call murder in the Logan area, and, the rest were, at least half of them would have been what I would think are preventable health issues. And
Preventable health, diabetes,
alcohol
abuse.
Things that our people face, whether it be health issues that come from lack of education around food or, you know, anything like that. And it just made me so wild. I was like, you know, why is this happening? Why have I already been to this many funerals? Why is it normal that my uncles hang themselves, you know? And, and it just... It made me angry. My first reaction was, I don't want to punch someone, you know? And luckily, I could stop myself from doing that. And over the next few weeks, I started seeing everybody's comments of, oh, well, that's Logan for you. Of course they're going to do that. And, you know, the funny thing is that we've faced a lot of stuff as blackfellas, but then the way that people talk about Logan, it doesn't matter whether you're black, white or whatever. If you're from Logan, then whatever, you know. So if you're a blackfella from Logan, then, you know, you get it twice as bad. And I just thought it was crap. I thought it was a load of crap. I'm from Logan. You're from Logan. Olympians are from Logan. Savage Garden is from Logan. I knew all of these people who are from Logan, and they've done better than all the people that are talking all this crap. And that's when I started the... I never meant it to be a campaign at first, but I started the No More Lives Lost campaign because when it come down to it, I just knew that, you know, some of the islanders that we were... the blackfellas were fighting... some of them were cousins of my best friends as well. And when it came down to it, all we want to achieve is no more lives lost. We're all angry at each other.
Tell us about the campaign. What are you doing?
The first project that we had was called the Logan State of Mind Exhibition. And for me, that was about profiling young, under 30s, people of whatever nationality who I felt were doing successful things or, you know, trying to be a successful person. Mm. And they were real. We've all been through some, you know, challenges in our life, but we haven't let that stop us from doing, you know, whatever it is that we want to do. Mm. So that was about profiling, and then also giving some younger artists, again, the chance to get up there and gain some experience. And
you're an artist yourself. I mean, you were talking before about, you know, you get this anger, frustration out in different ways.
Yep.
And you were talking before about a rap you've got. Do you want to share that with us?
Yeah, I can.
You
want to
do that?
The rap that I'm going to share with you, it's about deaths in custody, and it was I just started studying at the Aboriginal Centre for the Performing Arts, and it was through there that I was given the tools to be able to express my anger in a more positive way rather than fighting, like, you know, that's how we grew up dealing with things, I suppose. This is it. Daniel Yok and Dumaji and everybody before and between, the truth is far from what's perceived. Do you really expect me to believe that there's no racism in these streets when my people are getting beat down by prejudice in our town, getting locked up for making a sound or simply for just being around? Death in custody is what's really going down. Back at school, I was present in my history lessons, but never taught about my people who had faced oppression, and never told that with my graduation I would see my cousins facing intimidation, causing retaliation, sitting in interrogation, then incarceration if they survived the assault after the chasing. But things are changing. We're no longer the blacks who just sit back too scared to react. We're going to make it heard through poetic attacks like TLK say, yeah, we still call Australia home. But if you look in Oz's history closet, you'll find too many bones with just Ninganar attacks alone, stereotyping us as drones. Not every black fella drinks or sniffs on chrome. So why don't you, Nings, just leave us alone?
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, in that you can hear a frustration and anger, but you can also hear a love in there. A love of people, a love of your own family and friends and people that are close to you. It's beautiful. I think that sense, too, of trying to find outlets that are positive in our life are always important, and finding artistic outlets are amazing. I think that artists and sports people are often the people who are in the public more often than not. You know, we see them, and I think, you know, we've got the Nicky Winmar one up there with that famous image pointing at that famous black belly. Auntie Matilda, oh, I don't know if I should ask you what you think of that photo, but...
I can't look now.
But you've got to look at that finger too. That finger's not that pointing finger. That finger's that other image finger. That he's saying, no, you look here, like this. When you see that, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, from that picture, I see a proud man who's proud of who he is. Mm-hmm. And the colour of his skin. I don't know whether he would have faced challenges because of his colour. He might have grew up facing those challenges. Mm. And for him to stand there and point to that, it just tells a big story. Mm. That he's a proud and a strong Aboriginal man.
Mm. Yeah. Shane, and also recently, you know, we've looked at Adam Goods and the whole ape discussion that came through. I mean, you've been on the field there. You've felt like that. When you see that image or you hear about that ape discussion, what does it make you feel as a sportsman? Or is it even a person?
Yeah, I think people got to understand how hard it is for them to do something like that. You know, I've been on the footy field, you know, and faced, you know, racial taunts throughout my career. And, you know, for what they did...
Racial taunts? What? I mean, I don't know if we should repeat it, but what do they say?
Oh, you know, black this and black that, and even in England, I got called a packy. over there, they're quite racist towards Pakistani people, and yeah. So for them to come out and do that on their home ground is a big thing. Mm. And it's not easy. It's taking a stance, and you know, again, Adam Goods caught some slack for pointing the poor girl out for, you know, for what she did. But if you look at the big picture, you know, that's being fed up, you know, fed down, I should say, from her parents. And, you know, if it's got to stop somewhere. So if he doesn't do anything there, it just continues and she passes it on to her kids and, you know, and they'll pass it on. So but what he did, he took a stance and I thought he handled the situation incredibly well.
But you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. You know, you're a player, you're on the field, people throw taunts at you all the time, white, black, whatever. You know, should you stand up and say, you know, draw attention to your blackness, when in fact, you know, you're just a player in a team? Why should you be any different to anyone else? You know, when the Greeks or the Italians or the, you know, the Samoans, the other Pacific Islanders are playing and there's racial taunts, why is that any different for an Aboriginal person? Why shouldn't they just take it?
Yeah, and... again, you know, I copped it, and you just, some people just get used to it, and you grow a second skin and try and block it out. But you know, there's a time when enough's enough, and you know, in these two cases, Goods and Nicky Winmar, you know, they'd had enough, and they were taking a stance, and they were putting it out there, you know, in the public eye that this is enough, and it doesn't just happen on the footy field, obviously, and you know, I think, you know, standing up. Is, you know, it was fantastic standing up to people.
Well, being heard in that way.
Yeah.
Uncle Graham, did you see the film The Sapphires?
No.
Oh.
No. Sorry.
Uncle.
No, I thought it was too girly for me, see? But... oh, dear. But I was blown away by you know, the Vietnam thing, you know, and to know that our people was part of that too. It did. And I thought, man, this has got more depth to it than, you know, just being pretty voices and faces. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I never watched it all the way through, I've got to admit that. but I caught what was being portrayed here.
Okay,
but that was incredible, and these are these hidden stories, you see. That's what makes it so wonderful, because of these hidden stories. You know, there are anecdotes and people that have done tremendous things, yet nobody knows about them. Mm. Nobody has taken the time out to have a look and shine a light in there somewhere.
Mm. Yeah, I want to challenge you on this. I think our community knows about it.
Yeah.
Yes, true.
Let's say like Stolen Generations.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember we were...
No, I'm talking about the wider audience, the general public.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got so many stories to tell.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I've just done a show called Black Diggers, which is about Aboriginal servicemen of World War One. And then we're doing the research and realizing that Aboriginal soldiers or Aboriginal trackers and people went to the Boer War. And you start to go, what? Mm. What? They're not even citizens. What are they doing that for?
No, our uncle, his name, when we talk about somebody who passed on in our family, we've got to say Wawu in front of his name. Wawu, Mugai Wawu, Patrick Brady. He was in the Boer War. Mm. He was a light horseman.
Yeah.
Johnny Brady, if you know him, it's Johnny Brady's father. Oh. He was in the First World War, 1914. Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting. From Queensland, there was... Oh, now... In Queensland, there was a group of about 40 Aboriginal soldiers that were a reinforcement troop for the light horse. And so it was the only... There was an integrated army in World War One. Aboriginal soldiers... alongside non-Indigenous soldiers, except for this group, which was about 40 Indigenous horsemen. And I just think, imagine in Palestine, these 40 black fellas riding down. It scared the shit out of anyone, I think. You know, it's going boom down. But all these amazing stories that come through, and like the Sapphires. Kayla, going back to the Sapphires, have you seen the film?
Yes, a million times.
A million times. Not too girly for you?
No. No, the Sapphires is actually... it being released is a really big memory that will always stay with me because my Nan, she loves Jessica Mowboy. Like, she's always telling me how, oh, you should act. And I'm like, Nan, I'm not an actor, I'm a rapper. And she's like, yeah, well, Jessica wasn't an actor either, but look at her now. But, you know, when it came out, I went and watched it with some of my actor friends and I was... It was just so deadly. Like, I felt so much from it and... I texted my Nan. My Nan can text too. She's deadly. I texted my Nan and I said, Nan, get ready. I'm picking you up tomorrow morning. And then she was texting me going, but where are we going? And I said, just get ready. And she, but I don't know what to wear. And I got there. She wasn't ready because she didn't know where we were going. But anyway, I told her we're going to the movie. So I took her to see Sapphires. And it was the first time she'd been to the cinemas probably in, I think she said, like 20 years or something like that. And we sat down and I just because I loved it, I was crying when the first name came up. But by the end of it, Nan, you know, because she was singing along to the songs and then she was laughing along and at the end she was clapping. And when I looked at her, she had tears in her eyes and, you know, it made me really happy to see, you know, following Brand New Day. Mm. It was just that there were... blackfellas on the screen and there was a whole cinema full of people watching them and they enjoyed it and, you know, there were people that I knew up there and then it was stories getting told and then I was able to take my Nan to see something that she appreciated and it meant something to her, you know, and yeah, and it was just, it's more than just a movie, you know.
Mm. Well, talking about relatives, Matilda, I'm going to ask you about your auntie Pauline Hanson.
Oh, terrible.
Oh, man. See that family resemblance? No, look, poor thing. No, we were joking before. Often in family, in you know, when there's someone you don't quite, you know, you're going, oh, your uncle, your auntie, not mine. So there's a whole kind of, you make a connection, you make a family connection, but you do it in that kind of sly gammon way. I mean, she was a pretty formidable force. I mean, not so much now. Her maiden speech kind of fired a whole range of ways of thinking. How did that maiden speech make you think?
No, I didn't want to listen to it.
Didn't want to?
No. Yeah. For me, she was trouble. So I didn't really listen to her speech. She was just very mouthy.
Very mouthy.
Is that the right word? Is that the English word? Auntie Pauline, yeah.
Yeah. But that sense, some, you know, do you shut off?
I shut off.
Do you shut off the things you don't agree with? Or do you have to listen to them and go, oh, how do I talk to this?
At that time I did not want to pollute my intelligence with such.
I don't know. Sometimes it's that thing, you know, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. Mm. Kayla, what do you think about that?
I'm the opposite. I like to hear what they got to say. I don't know, I must like getting wild or something like that. No, it when I feel something, that's when I can create. And not so much Auntie there, but, you know, just in more recent years, you know, Tony Abbott, Campbell Newman, Bob, them coming in. And another big thing to me is, you know, I think it's silly that gay marriage isn't legalised, and they made it quite clear that they were against it. And I wrote a song about homosexuality and just how people treat that topic. And, you know, some people want to support it, some people don't think it's their business, and some people are totally against it. And, so I think Tony Abbott and Campbell Newman are stupid, but I still listen to what they got to say, because I need to know, you know, how can you debate something unless you know where they're coming from?
Mm. Wesley, that's really good. The incoming Human Rights Commissioner, anybody seen the what's name? Yeah, he was saying that more or less the same thing. You've got these things have to be said because that is part of the debate and the pros and cons of what makes a democracy. Mm. So where things are making you feel no good inside, things have to be said. It's like the sore, it has to fester to become better again. So even though Pauline Hanson has been as outspoken and has her views on issues of Asian influx into the country, it still does not take away what the majority of human beings feel. Mm. We could say that the minority, and probably her being a part of the minority, what is regarded as the minority, that have racist intentions or racial ignorance within their upbringing and within their community. When democracy was being developed in ancient Greece, the thinkers of the day were saying, you have to talk to the devil. You have to have conversations with the evil side. It's because if you do not know what they are saying, and I'm not saying that Pauline Hanson is evil. It's totally wrong. But these are the thinkers of the time, as we say that we live in a democracy derived from Greeks, the Greek way of democracy, that when these things occur, true human beings prevail. And what has happened, that you probably don't even know what was the first sentence in her speech, what she said, but everybody knows that she said something that was damning. But did it prevail? That is the understanding of keeping your enemies even closer, is that you got to get to know why these things occur. Good war, bad war. At war with each other, within your heart, within your community, within the steps that you take. So people are like that. And on the political front, where there are outspokenness in blatant racism or outspokenness in the gay issue, this is what makes us human. How can we point the finger at anybody else? We're all fallible.